Benvenuti ad Alma Lectio, il podcast dell'Università di Bologna dedicato alle Lectio Magistralis tenute da scienziati, intellettuali e personaggi illustri che nel corso degli anni sono stati invitati dall'Università di Bologna a condividere il loro sapere e contribuire alla divulgazione della conoscenza. Nella puntata di oggi ascoltiamo Judith Butler, una delle figure più importanti della filosofia contemporanea, con ricerche su tematiche di genere, identità, linguaggio e teorie queer e su violenza, etica e politica, che ha tenuto la sua conferenza il 7 maggio 2024 in occasione di un incontro dell'Università di Bologna aperto alla cittadinanza. Buon ascolto!
I want to thank the University of Bologna for the honor of visiting you and my two gracious hosts and the gender studies and the departments of gender studies and art and all of you for coming this evening to hear me, to think with me. Maybe it is just me, but I suspect you might share the sense that I have. State violence against people who are either rightless or struggling to acquire recognizable and durable rights used to be conducted under the name of another value. It was not violence, they used to say, but legitimate force used by the state to defend the nation, or the idea of the nation, or the people. It was not violence, they used to say, but a way of defending the rights of those who deserve to have rights. There were many ways to twist the arguments that state violence gave as the rationale for its death-dealing powers and the systematic way that people of color were targeted by the prison system. We were able to call it hypocrisy or a lie. We were able, in the past at least, to expose its ruse and to get on with the business of expanding alliances of resistance. But as we can see now, in the genocide that continues to be waged against the Palestinian people of Gaza, the exhibition of mass violence, of unthinkable cruelty, offers no excuse. It does not pretend to be anything other than shameless brutality. Of course, the Israeli state does claim it's not committing genocide, and it defends itself not by referencing the kind of violence it inflicts, but by claiming that genocide is only conducted against the Jews. Well, it surely was. That state argues that it is obscene to claim that the Israeli state is committing genocide, given what the Jews have suffered. And though these two forms of violence, the genocide against the Jews and the genocide against Palestinians, are certainly not organized in the same way, and they do not have the same proportions, it does not matter, since the definition of genocide in the Genocide Convention provides for various kinds of violence to fall under that description. Of course, it matters that atrocities were committed by Hamas on October 7th of 2023. They were horrific. There is, in my mind, no doubt. But that fact should hardly keep us from naming the massive killing of innocent lives that has happened every day since then against Palestinians. Nor should it keep us from understanding the current violence and attempted expulsion of the people of Gaza in the context of dispossession, bombardment, maiming, and traumatization that has, for decades, been the history of Palestine. The Nakba was an event in time, 1948, but it was also a way of structuring time ever since that time. It is a mode of perpetual dispossession and death dealing that continues to happen. What we have called the Nakba now takes the new form of a genocide from which many states and international institutions look away. One can explain Israeli state and military power in many ways, through its historical development, the technology it uses, the political form it both embodies and seeks to instate. Fascism is there, not only in the way that settlers are given guns and the authorization to act as rogue militias on the West Bank, but in the twisting and breaking of all laws, in the pursuit of murderous exhilaration, and in the targeting of women and children, healthcare workers, and those seeking to distribute food. Fascism in its current form is distinguished by repeated acts whereby people are stripped of their rights. But it is also characterized by the manifest joy and shamelessness by which people are stripped of their rights, or indeed their lives. Hardly any alibi needs to be given. In Gaza, but elsewhere, we can note the lack of any sign of regret, reluctance, the absence of any recourse to moral alibis on the part of the Israeli state, not only when taking away fundamental rights, but in exposing people from a distinctly social, religious, and racialized group to starvation, to injury, loss of limb, and loss of life. As many healthcare officials have already noted, the term trauma hardly works anymore to describe this situation, which challenges the very limits of thought. Yet, think we must, and speak and act. Of course, genocidal murder is not the same as rights stripping, but there is a connection. The shadow of genocide falls upon those stripped of fundamental rights, since once a group is stripped of basic rights, they are exposed without protection to debilitating and potentially fatal, life-negating forms of power. We have seen soldiers and militants celebrating murder, but we are also seeing right-wing activists and politicians celebrating rights stripping. They are not the same, but the accelerated normalization of rights stripping can lead to fascist political formations. And in Europe and in the United States, we also see the escalation of fascist passions. In the US, it would be difficult not to call fascist the call to eliminate trans and non-binary people. What did they have in mind when they made such a call? If they destroy the very category of transgender in an effort to show that trans people do not exist, they are calling for the eradication of the existence of trans people. Perhaps you are familiar with these quotations. Michael Knowles from the Daily Wire in the US, quote, "For the good of society, transgenderism," is his word, "must be eradicated from public life entirely," end quote, spoken at the Conservative Political Action Conference in May of 2023, of March of 2023. Knowles previously suggested that there can be no genocide against transgender people because they are, quote, "not a legitimate category of being," end quote. Such ontological wisdom from our most virulent critic, whose mastery of science and ontology is suddenly on trial. He remarked, and I quote, "I don't know how you could have a genocide of transgender people, because genocide refers to genes." It refers to genetics, to biology, Noel said on his show, and I quote, "And the whole point of transgenderism is that it has nothing to do with biology. Nobody's calling to exterminate anybody, because the other problem with that statement is that transgender people is not a real ontological category," he added. "It's not a legitimate category of being." Setting up a fight with me, all right. How's my English? It's okay? Oh, okay, good. Okay, that's it. You know, most Americans get up and like, rrr, 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 rrr. So it's important to know who you're speaking with, and I see you have support. Very good. As you know, it is one thing to say that biology determines who we are, and quite another to say that biology is always in the mix of who we are and what we become. Most feminists, queer and trans people, have questions about biological determinism or biological reductionism. What Michael Knowles fails to grasp is that his enemies do not deny biology, but they do contest biological determinism. In addition, when people claim that gender advocates reject science, they fail to consider how much science actually supports their views. No matter which political position one takes, it makes sense to ask which science is being used for which political position. Equally, it is important to show that interactive models of biology dispute the assertion that nature, or what is natural in us, operates independently of its interaction with the human world, the built environment, and the infrastructures of life. One reason it is important to underscore the difference between the sex assigned at birth and the relation we take to that assignment in the course of life is because that assignment tells us very little about what relation we will develop toward that assignment in time. We may love that assignment and occupy the assigned category with joy, or we may find that it is a site of ambivalence or unlivable suffering. The complexity of gender attests to the variability of that lived relation to the categories that others have assigned us. To be assigned a sex may well come with all sorts of social expectations, but the sex we are assigned gives no guarantee of the sex that we will become. We thank Simone de Beauvoir for this insight into the importance of becoming and the difficult struggle that we call freedom. That gap between being called a sex at birth and becoming a sex in time is actually also life and time. For categories such as sex and gender have a temporal life, and the trajectory of historical categories intersect with our own life histories. Now, it may seem strange to refer then to Palestine in the midst of such a discussion. But we can see that shameless rights stripping and unconscionable exposure to violence are but two dimensions of contemporary fascism. The shameless joy in killing or exposing others to slow death, the production of famine, the eradication of all legal rights, and the flagrant violation of all international rights characterize this fascism as well. Genocide in Palestine, and we have every right and obligation to use that term, is made possible by genocidal logics that most states and world institutions have come to accept or are willing to consider. This genocide emerges in the midst of other forms of death dealing that may feel more proximate and that allow for deaths in the name of the nation and nationalism and defy international conventions. the pushback deaths at sea, the deaths of migrants in detention camps, the suspension of all due process for those held in indefinite detention, along with the absence of adequate shelter and health care for many living at the border. Are these practices on a continuum with other forms of fascist rights stripping? What about the replacement theory that runs through all of these instances? Why does the acknowledgement of trans rights or rights of lesbian and gay parenting often seem to their opponents as a threat to their own rights? What is taken away from heterosexuals if marriage is extended to gay and lesbian people? What is truly taken away from women assigned female at birth if trans women are women, legally and socially? Is the dominant class replaced by the vulnerable community? I think not. And yet, how often do we see this power attributed to those who are struggling for basic rights from a situation of vulnerability? When one suggests, for instance, that a one-state solution that guarantees rights for all people, regardless of religion, race, or background, might put an end to violence in Palestine and Israel, it might allow for the realization of equality and freedom for everyone, one is very often accused of anti-Semitism or even terrorism. Under what conditions does a version of radical democracy with the aim of establishing true peace become construed as part of a hostile war effort or a call for violent overthrow? The Israeli state very often imagines that living on the basis of equality with Palestinians would mean the destruction of the Jewish state and hence the destruction of the Jewish people, genocide again. They make that assumption precisely because Israel falsely claims to represent all the Jewish people, which means that any opposition to Israel is an opposition to the Jews themselves. And those Jews, like myself, who oppose what Israel is doing are called un-Jews. I don't know how you do that. Okay. Effectively stripped of their rights to speak as Jews. The replacement theory has long operated for Israel as a rationale for maintaining demographic advantage for the Jewish population. It is said that forfeiting the rights to demographic advantage for Jews would lead to the replacement of Jews by Palestinians or Arabs more broadly. But what if Jews and Palestinians were able to live as equal citizens of the land? What if they lived under a constitutional democracy that they were both part of realizing? Every vision of cohabitation in the region, of equal citizenship, of a state, single, dual, or federated, that would put an end to colonization and to uprising, is often regarded as nothing other than a threat to Jewish life. Since when are the values of equality and freedom inimical to Jewish life? It is not my conception of Jewish life. Indeed, I was taught as a young Jew that we fought for justice, that we name inequality and injustice, not just for the Jews, but for everyone. Thank you. There are fears at the heart of some of the central phantasms stoking fascist passions during our time, when gender-critical feminists and the right-wing allies, a misnomer because they do not understand critical, critical is not negative, critical is the inquiry into taken-for-granted presumptions in order to imagine a different world, okay. when they claim that trans women will substitute for them or rob them of their maternity or steal their identity or appropriate femininity for themselves, they are gripped by a phantasm. They are imagining being replaced by those who want to live, who want the right to live in freedom without fear of violence, discrimination, and pathologization, with affirmative health care, shelter, and employment. The great replacement theory articulated with such toxic force by Orban and Meloni alike figures the most vulnerable migrant washing up on the shore as a major threat to the nation, the family, and the very future of Europe. We might well wonder how such phantasmatic transfigurations can take place. I hope to articulate the logic of this process as I go along. But to do that, I have to return to this phenomenon of exhilarated sadism, now increasingly shameless, that describes fascist excitation in our times, the excitement that accompanies the call to deny people of fundamental rights. Let us ask first, what makes that call exciting? What kind of excitement is involved in making or receiving that call? One reason I am interested in this excitement is that it is enigmatic to me. As I began my remarks, we are used to charging governments and agencies with indifference when they fail to protect the fundamental rights of people. And in those cases, we consider those institutions to be unfeeling or cold, engaged in a lethal form of turning away. Gilles Deleuze, writing on Sade in 1967, insisted that we were looking at a phenomenon characterized by coldness and cruelty. And yet, to say that cruelty is cold is not to say it is dispassionate. And in its contemporary form, I would argue, there is often a kind of self-righteous passion that accompanies the decision to let migrants die at sea, or perhaps a religious excitement about stripping people of their fundamental rights. Although these are not the exact same phenomenon, something intersects here, not a joyous fascism, but an excited one that takes hold and makes itself known when rights of parenting are denied to gay and lesbian people, or when gay marriage rights are withdrawn, or when reproductive justice is dismantled, and when rights to determine sex assignment are proscribed. What characterizes the passions that I wish to describe today is that they are felt as moral and lived as shameless. Or they begin as forms of violence felt to be morally justified, only to be released from all moral justification and constraint. The moral dimension of their expression operates surely as a kind of justification for doing harm, but it is also the vehicle of their accelerated excitation. Indeed, those who ban books on gender from classrooms, take sex education out of schools, strip trans youth of affirmative health care, refuse to let the history of slavery be taught, support the abandonment of migrants at sea or their indefinite detention within camps or prisons, understand themselves as doing good, as restoring the good life, or as warding off a corrosive, dangerous force, or even the force of evil. It would be one thing to say that they do harm and then supply a moral justification for doing so. That would make them devious or hypocritical. The situation, however, is, I think, actually worse. They understand themselves as not doing harm at all, but doing good, and they conceive of rights stripping or fatal abandonment as activities that will help to restore a world they understand themselves to have lost. Sometimes that kind of argument goes even further. The only way to restore the good life, the natural family, including gender hierarchies, is through right stripping or potentially fatal forms of social abandonment. These are measures that must be taken, the argument goes, to achieve or restore the good life or in the name of the good itself. And to the extent that these measures are conceived as preconditions of the good life, or rather its restoration, then the very act of taking rights away or denying a group of people the possibility of life and legal status becomes itself a good deed, an activity that realizes the good in the course of doing what it does. To understand this, we would have to understand the thrills of expulsion and dispossession coupled with the moralized right to turn away. If one understands the harm one is doing to be morally right, to be justified in advance, and to be bringing back the good life, then whatever one has to do to realize that end would seem to be justified. It is so, however, only if the means serves the ends. But if one does not realize that what one is doing is harmful, then there is no need to justify the harm. A full transvaluation of values has occurred for those who have undergone this conversion. And as a consequence, one is thus freed of traditional moral constraints and authorized to act in ways that would otherwise be called harmful, with the full conviction that one's action is right or good, that it restores good to the world, or that it makes a bad world good again, or that it safeguards the world against an impending and unthinkable destruction. If one says that this action that others call harmful is actually beneficial, then one has turned or reversed the meaning of words that name moral values. The problem is not just some generalized semantic confusion, since the conviction is passionate. And by passion, I mean not just any emotional state. Passion, as you would all know, emerges from the Latin for suffering, but also enduring. It is different from an affection that one can reflect upon in the mind. A passion implies being affected by something from the outside, enduring that condition of that has the quality of being out of one's control. A passion is, to some extent, something ungovernable or not thoroughly governable that one undergoes. The mind cannot master a passion or has difficulty doing so. A passion, always more or less, governs the mind, leaving one both out of control and excited. Excited to be out of control, excited finally to be out of control, ungoverned and ungovernable. Something lawless is in the air, lawless and yet in the name of a morality realized in depriving and dispossessing others. Under the guise of morality, here comes the possibility of living in a lawless way or to develop laws that consecrate that lawlessness as when the government, in its policies and laws, not only stokes such passions, but recasts them as moral mission or even crusade. The experience of what is right under such conditions becomes self-righteous moralism, and it permits of various kinds of cruelty in the name of what is considered right and good. It is not morality which would have to explain the principles by which it acts. No, it is an excited moralism outside the law, now operating within the law, freeing those most besieged by hatred to do whatever harm they wish, to incite and circulate hatred in the name of what is right. It is, I would suggest, no accident that we have arrived at a language of governance, of becoming ungovernable, and this may well point us in the direction of answering the initial question, namely, how do we explain the excited character of fascist passions, especially as they operate in the anti-gender ideology movement? In particular, how do we explain the excited character of doing harm that is fortified by the conviction that one is either doing good or more messianically, restoring good to an ailing or imperiled world. What we know about passion is that it has a passive element, that it is undergoing something that seems to have an origin external to the self, and that it is either a temporary or enduring state of feeling or being ungovernable. What then would make a passion or set of passions ungovernable? Well, if a heightened political discourse on the right tells you that your life is being threatened, well, you will tend to rise up against whatever it is that has been identified as a threat to your life. That makes sense. But if that same authority in its discourse tells you the only way to keep your life, or perhaps your way of life, is to deny or destroy the rights of others, then you are, as it were, being conscripted into a war, pitting your own life against others. You are told that your rights, your right to life, will be taken away from you by some people unless you move quickly to take away their rights, sometimes even their right to life. You are then fighting for the good at the same time that you are able to mobilize your desire to destroy others, your long-standing resentments, or your newly incited forms of disdain. All this can happen apart from a fascist state or a thoroughly fascist society. For fascism, as we know, as Italy knows, begins as a trend, a potential. Thus, it is our obligation as critics to find and oppose those potentials before they saturate society and its state structures. Thus, we do not have to see a fully fledged fascist state to say that fascist trends and practices are happening now when various vulnerable communities are targeted with rights stripping, fatal abandonment to perilous conditions, and slow and quick forms of killing are both becoming the norms, assisted by exhilarated forms of moralism. Something ungovernable rails against government and regulations, including protections and rights, and yet it also supports a state that will dismantle precisely those public goods and obligations. But there is another element here, the phantasm that takes the place of the enemies who must be stripped of rights, including the rights to life, whether that is the teacher who is said to indoctrinate or groom the student to be gay, the trans woman in prison who is said to do harm, the gender theorist who assumes demonic form in the media and is said to attack the laws of nature and the rules of the church. The trans child in need of good care is seen to threaten the core of the nation, the migrant or the colonized seeking to live in freedom, equality, and justice in a shared world. Are they really the dangers that are being posed today? Those who are figured as threats to the people are by definition separated from the people, not part of the people, and as such, they, those non-people, they must be disempowered if not eliminated. They have no right to live in the common world. The common world is divided into the people who have such a right, those who legitimately count as the people, and those who do not. But as we know, this is not a just arrangement. It relies on splitting, inequality, and a phantasmatic reorganization of reality. The idea of gender has operated as an excitable concept in contemporary politics, and many political campaigns target gender as a destructive force and construe this gender as a threat to national identity and the natural family. The Vatican has added to this discourse by likening gender to a nuclear bomb, the Ebola virus, and Hitler Youth. When gender is figured as a threat to humanity, civilization, man, and nature, when gender is likened to a nuclear catastrophe or full-blown demonic power, then it is the fear of destruction to which political actors are appealing. Of course, there is a ready and continuous fear of destruction. Probably most of us feel this. The source of that fear is difficult to name. It is solicited and spiked to fortify both religious authorities and state powers, or their strengthening alliance, as we see in Putin's Russia, the Republican Party in the US, and various countries in Eastern Europe, East Asia, and Africa, and here in Italy. The displacement of this fear of destruction from its conditions of production, climate disaster, systemic racism, capitalism, carceral powers, extractivism, patriarchal social and state forms, results in the production of cultural figures and phantasms invested with the fantasy power to destroy the earth and the fundamental structures of human societies. Precisely because that destruction is happening without being named and checked, the fear and anxiety congeal without a proper vocabulary or analysis, and gender or critical race studies are targeted as the cause of destruction. Gender, a category that describes the division of labor, the organization of states, the unequal distribution of power, has never been merely cultural, but it is cast that way by opponents who want to identify the source of the destruction, the fear of destruction, at the cultural level. And once gender is identified as a cause of destruction, something to be feared, gender itself must be destroyed. And what follows is censorship, the de-departmentalization of gender studies and women's studies, the stripping of rights of healthcare, increased pathologization, the repeal or rejection of laws that protect against discrimination, inevitably violent marginalization, and the erosion of democratic norms. Let us remember that the killing of women, trans, queer, bisexual, and intersex people is a form of destruction actually taking place in the world as we speak. The killing of black women, black, queer, and trans people, the killing of migrants, including queer and trans migrants, all these are actually destructive acts happening in this time, our time. And as those numbers increase, it becomes increasingly apparent whose lives are considered dispensable and whose lives are not. And in this way, the inequality of the grievable makes itself known. Once gender comes to include, as it always has, abortion rights, access to reproductive health care, sexual health services, trans rights, women's freedom and equality, queers of colors, freedom struggles, single parenting, gay parenting, new kinship outside of heteronormative models, adoption rights, sex reassignment, gender-confirming surgery, sex education, books for young people, books for adults, images of nudity. Well then, gender comes to represent a wide range of political struggles that its opponents seek to shut down in their effort to restore an authoritarian patriarchal order for the state, religion, and the family. The only way forward is for all those targeted to gather themselves more effectively than their enemies have, to recognize their alliance, and to fight the phantasms prepared for them with the powerful and regenerative counter-imaginary. If what I have described is true, it follows that fascist passions or political trends are those that seek to strip people of the basic rights they require to live, and to do so either without regard for their probable demise or, more likely, because fascism is an effective mode of annihilating those lives. Authoritarianism is usually understood as a form of state power, and yet authoritarian personalities flourish within democracies, stoking fascist passions where the fear of destruction converts into a moral alibi to destroy other people's lives. The authoritarian who seeks to stoke fascist passions knows too well that the fear of destruction already courses through those who are seeing the destruction of the earth, the environment, the destruction of labor unions, prospects for financial security. It is inflamed and organized by the phantasm of anti-gender ideology that locates destruction as emanating from foreign and elite powers, engaging age-old conspiratorial logics to prop up anti-democratic regimes. And if the foreign sources are characterized as Jewish, then that is apparently all the more effective in converting the fear of destruction into fascist passion. Perhaps arguments won't address the fear of destruction that motivates the anti-gender ideology movement. That movement taps into a sense of the world on its inevitable way to self-immolation. It draws upon those kinds of fears to rally support for its legitimately destructive plan. I say that in quotes. There's hardly an example of the anti-gender ideology movement that does not claim to be saving its believers, particularly the children, from harm. And the movement finds, stokes, and organizes that fear of destruction wherever it can. Nothing could be more personal and singular than the fear for one's bodily safety or that of one's children or those who are most proximate. But the real fear is felt by those groups, by those grouped unwillingly under the term gender, and not by those who propagate the fear. The fear is the fear of being injured, killed, pathologized, or incarcerated on the part of trans kids who are hurt by this movement that claims to be saving the children. Equally painful is the fear that women feel on the streets as they seek simply to live their lives and move freely without fear. To realize how many women and LGBTQIA plus people are seized with fear on the street, in the workplace or in their homes, is to know how pervasive and corrosive that fear can be. And it matters, in the US, for instance, how many black and brown people undergo that fear in proximity to the police or the store owner who regards them with suspicion, or how many young black people in the US have their breath choked out of them by self-justifying police. It's a singular fear for one's life, and at the same time, it is also someone else's, the one that someone felt before they died, the one a parent felt when they sent their kid for groceries at the corner store. What if political movements were forged from all those who fear discrimination and violence in public and private spaces, who demand to live and love freely without fear of violence? Perhaps then the fear of destruction could be identified in a way that shows how its fascist exploitation is so egregiously wrong. In considering the operative fantasies about migrants elaborated in support for xenophobic and racist migration policy, or the operative fantasies about women as child murderers in the anti-abortion movements, or those that figure trans women as cis rapists infiltrating bathrooms, we are encountering phenomena that are at once social and psychological. When fear runs through a population, when hatred is stoked against a concept or an idea such as gender, or populations represented by the idea of gender, that is said to wield the power of total destruction, then the tools we need to understand, deflate, and oppose such a movement are drawn from media with the power to occupy and dispel the phantasm in the service of another way to imagine alliance. We need this way of imagining solidarity going forward as much as we need air to breathe, for living on and living on together requires solidarity and a sense of living that includes and exceeds the basics of human life. Consider that when... Thank you. Consider that when the anti-gender movement says that gender, whatever it is, it's an animated force of destruction, that gender will strip you of your sexed identity. They confess the rights stripping that they are actually advocating. They ask the public to experience the psychosocial fantasy of being stripped of a sexed identity by law, when what is really happening is that trans people are asking to be able to assign themselves a new sex status, and those who oppose gender are stripping them of rights. It is a malicious yet powerful inversion. This right to self-determination, to decide one's sex status in the world, takes no one else's rights away. And yet, if this freedom of self-definition is allowed, it is said, the gender ideologues will strip everyone else of their sex assignment. Do you know anyone who has proposed that? No. It doesn't matter because it's not based on evidence. Self-assignment, understood as a form, a fundamental form of freedom, is thus twisted into a rights-stripping activity in order to justify stripping trans people of their rights. Similarly, queer families do not negate heterosexual ones. They only dispute the inevitability and superiority of the heteronormative family form. Those who defend the family are being asked to accept a world in which families take various forms and to understand that they are living in only one such form. This is not a future world we are talking about, but this world, the one in which we are living now. It can feel overwhelming, these attacks. How to call all of these inversions, these attacks on legitimate freedom, how to call them out in the most public of terms? Can the psychosocial dimension of new fascism become understandable in terms that everyone impacted will understand? Without that psychosocial analysis, we cannot come to know how our most intimate fears and desires are woven into the social fabric in which we live, including the social ruptures and conflicts, those tears in the fabric that pitch into precarity, whose exploitation we can only live through if there are others who refuse to let us fall. As I've tried to argue, this heightened focus on gender by the right deflects from the various social and political forces that are, in fact, destroying the world as we know it. Even so, we cannot conclude that gender is only a deflection from these other and more truly destructive forces, for gender relates to an intimate sense of lived bodily experience, a sense of who one is, and sometimes to an anchor that holds the architecture of the ego together. To be told that sex assigned at birth is not necessarily the same as a sex assumed in time is unsettling, even disturbing, but only for those who want to think of their own sex assignment less as a legal act conducted in relation to codified norms than as an immutable truth of the self. Well, okay, maybe some do live gender as immutable. That is surely acceptable as long as the assumption is not made that everyone lives it that way. To derive from that experience a theoretical generalization or indeed a universal rule is to impose a cruel falsehood on those who are living gender differently. And yet gender is presented as frightening, not only because it exposes that what was once taken to be immutable is actually mutable, but because if someone else can engage in gay sex or sex reassignment or enjoy sexual imagery that another denies to oneself, then the other is living out what feels to be an impossible human possibility. That denial becomes a requirement of selfhood. And so these lives over there, the other, they are living out what one has established as unthinkable for oneself. To make them unthinkable means that they cannot be imagined, so when they do appear, they appear as phantasms with the power to destroy a heteronormative self that has grounded itself on their denial. And of course, trans people can be thinkable and imaginable by those who do not follow that course of being. The same applies to abortion or with lesbian and gay sexuality. You don't have to do it to imagine it and to accept it as a possibility and even a right. But for some, once these issues become thinkable, public, and imaginable, they do not appear as possibilities, but rather as monsters, phantasms, aimed at destroying the self, convenient catch-alls for the world's catastrophes. The foreclosure of these issues leads to their return in paranoid phantasms. And under certain political conditions, those phantasms can be circulated to gain support for movements that target gender and promise to restore patriarchal orders that thrive on vibrant and toxic tautologies. Sex is sex, and no debates or changes allowed. In that infamous Marbella speech, Meloni chanted, "No to gender ideology, yes to sex identity." Sick. Okay. Earlier in 2020, Meloni addressed the National Conservatism Conference in Rome on the topic of God, homeland, family, where she defended the natural family, opposing abortion as inhumane. In her view, quote, "They would like us to give up defending the family, considering it to be an archaic and backward concept to be superseded. They would like to convince us that a family is any emotional bond between sentient beings, that it is a sign of great civil and moral progress to pay a poor mother to keep her child in her womb for 9 months and then snatch it from her arms to give it away to whoever has bought it. We reject all this without a moment's hesitation, even though today it is considered highly scandalous and even revolutionary to say that a family is made up of a man and a woman and any son they may have." Any son. "It is not scandalous, but it is surely false." Although she's now trying to advertise herself as a centrist, this is fascist rhetoric, warning against the powers of those gender ideologists who will destroy the social bedrock of the self and its most intimate relations, parenting rights, and the right to live in the sex that one is. And yet, these are among the very rights for which most gender advocates are struggling. Here the right shares a supposition with the trans exclusionary feminists. Sex is a property to which one has exclusive rights, and any effort to challenge the property framework is a ruse of those seeking to steal or appropriate what is not rightfully their own. But note the structure here. The destruction that one causes is said to have its cause in those it seeks to destroy. Destruction has, through the syntax of the phantasmatic, been relocated in another part to another part of the scene so that one is now free to destroy because what one destroys has been rhetorically and ideologically established as the cause of destruction. This is not an argument. It is a phantasmatic scene which allows those it benefits not to see the contradiction in which they are engaged. They will take your rights away. We are opposed to those rights being taken away, so we will take their rights away without noticing that we are contradicting ourselves. Throughout the anti-gender ideology movement, a morally righteous sadism has triumphed over the powers of capacious alliance or any commitment to cohabitation on the basis of equality. This form of sadism rides on the conviction that fueling hatred is the only way to save the world, that only by destroying will destruction come to an end. It intensifies destructiveness in the world in the name of saving the world from destruction. And the attack on the healthcare rights of trans youth is undertaken in the name of saving children from harm. But here again, the attack on the right to healthcare is itself the harm, the claim to be saving youth by denying them education and healthcare actually hurts the youth. And because this aggression against young people is moralized, it facilitates sadism with a moral alibi. In thinking about, here I'm going to end soon because I'm going too slowly. Okay, I'm almost done. In thinking about our own strategies of resistance, it is crucial that gender politics oppose neoliberalism and other forms of capitalist devastation and not become their instrument, that it militates against the continuing of colonization and all forms of racism, including those afflicting migrants, and that it takes its stand within expanding alliances on the left. It cannot simply be an identity politics and still create the world in which we all want to live. It is by virtue of our interdependency that we stand a chance of surviving and flourishing. Can we make alliances that reflect that interdependency with both human and non-human life, one that will oppose climate destruction and stand for a radical democracy informed by socialist ideals? The fear of gender is also the potential for the fear of gender is figured by the right as a potential for universal salvation, but we have a different notion of universality in mind. When gender politics remains restricted to the liberal sphere of individual rights, it cannot address the basic rights to housing, food, non-toxic environments, the right to be free of unpayable debt, the right to health care that should belong to any struggle for social and economic justice. And when countries and regions are coerced into accepting a version of rights that leaves their basic needs unaddressed, it is no wonder that skepticism emerges towards those very rights. And when those rights are framed in terms that do not translate well into local cultures, then the critique of cultural imperialism is not without justification. For the critique of financial coercion and cultural imperialism to become an integral part of a transnational gender politics, we will need to live with our profound differences without succumbing to the destructive forms we oppose. The only way out of this bind is to ally the struggle for gender freedoms and rights with the critique of capitalism and colonialism, to formulate the freedoms for which we struggle as collective ones, and to let gender become part of a broader struggle for a social and economic world that eliminates precarity and provides healthcare, shelter, and food across all regions. Such an agenda would develop an understanding of the formation of the individual within a social world, the individual body as bearing the trace of the social in its relations with others, both actual and implied, a body at once porous and interdependent. It would mean accepting that, as human creatures, we persist only to the extent that we are bound up with one another. When we say, I want to be free, or that I want you to be free, we are speaking about these distinct selves, but also about social freedoms that should be accorded to everyone as long as no real harm is done. And for that caveat to work, we have to expose the fear-mongering that would recast fundamental freedoms as harms and make freedom into a new and vital object of desire. To live according to such a maxim means that we must distinguish between actual harms and those that grip the imagination as imminent possibilities. But we cannot learn how not to cause harm if freedom itself is regarded as a harm, or if we become convinced that struggles for equality, freedom, and justice are hurting the world. Let us show instead that the world, the earth, depends upon our freedoms, and that freedom makes no sense when it fails to be collective. And no matter how difficult staying in emancipatory collectivities may be, it is imperative in order both to acknowledge our differences, some of them irresolvable, as we seek to build a world that affirms the equal value of our loves and our losses. Thank you.
Avete ascoltato la conferenza di Judith Butler, una delle figure più importanti della filosofia contemporanea, con ricerche su tematiche di genere, identità, linguaggio e teorie queer e su violenza, etica e politica, tenuta il 7 maggio 2024 in occasione di un incontro dell'Università di Bologna. Vi aspettiamo alla prossima Alma Lectio!